You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
I'm Molly Wansell.
And I'm Jeffrey Wansell.
And for the last 16 years or thereabouts, we have been having lunch every Saturday, and often our conversation turns to murder.
And that's what's prompted us to launch this true crime podcast called Blood Ties.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Blood Ties podcast. I'm Jeffrey Wansell. I thought we might do something rather different today, that we wanted to interview a true crime author, very talented American true crime author called Greg Olson, who has a new book just coming out in this country called American Mother, about a woman who poisoned her husband and also poisoned another woman almost by accident by doctoring the Tylenol tablets that they took. And so here's a conversation I had with Greg, which I hope you'll enjoy. I think it's fascinating. Well, Greg, welcome to Blood Ties podcast. Very good to have you with us, especially for all that way away, thousands and thousands of miles. But your book, American Mother, has just come out in Britain. And I've been doing this podcast for about 5 years, always about true crime. And so we thought it'd be very interesting to talk to someone who'd written a really good, and I do confess, I think it's a really good true crime book, about how you go about it, how you feel about it, and maybe even to ask you the simplest question of all, why did you choose this particular story? So let's begin at the beginning. Give us, you know, the speed dial version of what the book's about.
Well, the speed dial version is it's about a woman named Stella Nickel who decides that her life isn't going the way she wants it to go. She's in her 40s. Her husband no longer drinks, so he's not fun anymore, and she decides to kill him. And the way she does it is to reenact a very famous U.S. case, which was the Chicago Tylenol murders, which was it's never been solved. That perpetrator put cyanide in Tylenol capsules, put them out on the shelf, and seven people died. Stella got that idea. She thought, you know, I could get a hitman. I could run him over in a car. I could do all these other things, but I might get caught. But if I reenact that famous case from Chicago, no one will ever be the wiser. So that's what she did. She killed her husband and an innocent stranger, a mother of two named Sue Snow.
And essentially, the first question anyone will ask, I mean, I've done a number of true crime books myself, is why? Why? I mean, was it just she got boring, or did she want the insurance money, or what? What was
it? Of course. I mean, it's a combination of things. You know, it's not any one thing, but Stella wanted the money from the insurance. She had forged a bunch of policies. And
so how much money are you talking?
We're talking about probably $174,000. Okay. There were multiple policies. And here's the funny thing about insurance. You don't really know how many are out there. It's not like there's a repository that lists how many insurance policies somebody has. You only get them when it's called to your attention, when somebody wants to collect. Okay. So she wanted all that money for a big dream, which sounds so ludicrous, but she wanted a tropical fish store.
What?
That was her big dream. She was going to kill her husband and open up a tropical fish store because she was a fish aquarium fancier, and that was her hobby and that was her big dream, and that was worth killing for.
Goodness me. I'm not sure I'd kill for a tropical fish store, but never mind.
I know, it's low on the list, isn't it? I mean, I guess her backup plan, by the way, Jeffrey, was a ceramic store. She also thought it would be good to have one of those ceramic shops where you go in and, you know, you paint the ceramics and then fire them and everybody comes and oohs and ahs over the great craft that they, you know, the ashtray they made or whatever.
It's that thing that you and I both know only too well. It's evil is often so mundane, isn't it? I mean, a tropical fish store.
Absolutely is. When people say, you know, oh my gosh, she was what conniving, what was her devious plan? Well, her plan was, you know, what we would all think, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard.
Yeah.
You know, but it is. That's what she wanted.
Well, and she was a woman in her 40s, as you said. Presumably relatively intelligent.
I think she was smart or is smart. She's a smart woman, but again, all kinds of dumb going on too. I mean, she's street smart. She had come up, you know, the hard way with lots of trauma and drama in her life, right? So she was a survivor and a good one, but she was also the kind of person who, you know, she had this attitude that she was smarter than everybody, that she was very clever, that and nobody could quite catch on to what she was going to do. You know, she went as far as, you know, researching cyanide in the library. You know, she went in and checked out books and studied up on it. I mean, she was a good student of her crime, except she didn't realize that, you know, the biggest thing, and you know this for a fact, the biggest thing gets everybody caught is they talk to somebody.
Yeah.
That's it.
That's it.
I mean, if you keep your mouth shut and throw away the weapon, that's what I've always tell everybody. Keep your mouth shut, throw away the weapon, and you're good.
Yes, or at least you're a lot better than you do if you don't.
Yes.
Okay. So, but it wasn't just her husband and not just the insurer, but the irony and the awful irony was that she proceeded to kill another person.
Right. That's
a mother of a delightful, obviously, daughter.
Yes, she was a wonderful woman. Sue Snow was a bank manager. And here's the thing with Stella. Stella, you know, she did the cyanide poisoning. She called the police and they came and looked, and she kind of even indicated he was fine. It was sudden, you know, this couldn't possibly be anything but something very mysterious. So they did the autopsy and they foiled her plans because they never caught the cyanide. It's very hard to detect. Yeah. And the other thing is he had emphysema. So they said, oh, he died of emphysema. There's no insurance payout because, you know, murder, by the way, is considered an accidental death. So, you know, so you can collect on it. And she was upset about that. So she started calling. She would be calling, you know, the insurance people. She called the state where her husband worked for the state as a mechanic. And she kept calling and saying, you know, I don't think this is right. I don't think it's right. And finally, she had to resort to what was so terrible, which was to put more of those bottles out on grocery store shelves to kill an innocent victim so she'd have a reason to call in.
Yeah, which was her way of making sure she got the payout that she believed she needed. Yeah. So this is an extraordinary, in many ways, hypnotic story of a woman obsessed with a tropical fish store, a poor victim who did nothing except take Tylenol, and a daughter, the woman, the innocent victim's daughter, bereft in a nanosecond, in a heartbeat, literally.
It's so scary what, you know, when you think about a crime like what Stella Nickel did, you know, this is back in the late 80s when this happened.
Yeah.
She's been in prison all this time, but we didn't have that kind of, we didn't have school shootings. You know, we didn't have somebody going to a mall and taking out people. That didn't happen. We didn't have what we would call now domestic terrorism. No. So when somebody, you know, entered a toxic element into our food chain, it's a shock to think that you would be just doing your daily life. You have a headache, you go take a pill and you're dead.
Yeah.
Because somebody did that. So I really find that really one of the most chilling aspects of this crime is that it didn't matter who she killed. She just had to kill one more person.
Yeah, but what was that? Was that what drew you to this story that made you want to spend, I think you say in the book, years looking into it?
Yeah, I spent a couple of years on that project. And here's the thing. I think about the randomness of life. Mm-hmm. You and I are fine right now, but gosh, I could go get in my car and get killed, you know, in an accident, you know. But this was something on purpose, something that somebody else sent in motion intentionally. And that does fascinate me. Like, what kind of person would want a tropical fish store of all things so much that, you know, killing your husband is one thing, and then let's go kill somebody else? To me, that is really the most chilling, unforgivable crime of all.
Yeah, I agree with that wholeheartedly.
Jeffrey, don't you think in your own experiences, writing about it or interviewing people, when you think about murder, when it's a crime of passion or emotion or something like that, you can kind of maybe see something in that maybe I'm not talking about forgiveness for a person, but certainly an understanding. You know, yeah. I've been upset before too, and I've never killed anybody, but you know, some people do and have. So there's a connection between their emotion, but there's no emotion here.
No,
this is just for money.
Yes,
it's really, is that all it is?
It is the old one about banality of evil, as we were saying. Yeah. You know,
yes,
this woman is doing what she believes she has to do, whereas the reality is, of course, she doesn't have to do that. She could have probably got someone to support her, starting a fish store or a ceramic store or whatever else. But nevertheless, there's something going on there, and that's what I find very interesting. You know, I've done books about people, serial killers, and British ones, and I've done podcasts about a lot of television documentaries about Americans. But what's interesting about this is, in many ways, it's so suburban. We're not talking about the floating edges of society. Someone who kills sex workers or somebody kills vagrants. We're talking about somebody who lives in a suburban street, decides she wants to get rid of her husband.
It's really not that. It's really about the underclass and the people that, you know, Stella and her people are blue collar people living in a trailer park. Their big time out is having, you know, a six pack of beer somewhere. You know, they are the American that, you know, you might imagine from, I don't know, from TV or something.
Yeah, sure. But
they are, you know, their dreams are real simple and their wants are simple. This is nothing wrong with them. It's just how they've been raised and how, you know, I always say this to people, you know, and maybe it's true in your country too. Wherever you were born, it dictates so much of your life. It's very hard to get out of a circumstance. If you're born poor, you're likely staying there. That's just the way it is. And Stella's case, she comes from a whole line of abusive, cruelty, drunkenness, arrests, probably other murders. I mean, she has that pathway, you know, from the trailer park to the tropical fish store, and it's littered with the tragedy.
Yes. And yet the tragedy for Sue Snow and her daughter,
that's right,
has got absolutely nothing to do with anyone except Stella Nicol.
Yeah, that's a heartbreak. When I think about Haley Snow, who was 15 at the time when her mother was poisoned, and she found her in the bathroom.
Yeah.
You know, just in this agonal breathing, trying to, you know, to fight for her life. And she's like every girl everywhere. She's the school girl, and she's confused and she's upset and she's worried, but she even takes her homework to the hospital when her mother is in, you know, intensive care. That says so much to me about her, you know, about like, oh, we're going to be okay. You know, I'm going to go to school after my mom gets out of the intensive care. You know, there's something about that. Like, we're all hardwired in these moments where maybe in Haley's case, nothing bad's going to happen because nothing bad ever had. No. And with Stella, everything bad happens. So you just come to expect it.
Yeah, I think that's fine. And I think one of the things I liked most about the book was it dealt with the nuance of the elegance of the difficulties that people have dealing emotionally. As you say, I mean, Haley didn't expect her mother to die. Her mother certainly didn't expect to die. And you have this horror that's inflicted on perfectly ordinary people for no fault of their own. It's the random killer argument, isn't it? That, you know, we have them, you have them. This is the real tragedy.
It is. It's the lottery of murder. You just don't know when your number's up, because now anybody can be killed at any time. And before, you know, as one of the people in the story said, you know, the murder used to be kept in the family.
Yeah. You're most likely to kill someone you love or someone
right.
you know.
Now, not so true. I mean, I'm in the Seattle area, and we had another school shooting last week where a high school kid was killed. I mean, this is just common day occurrence now.
Yeah.
And but back then, it was impossible to even think of it, Jeffrey, that somebody would kill somebody for no reason.
Yeah. But what was it that specifically, I mean, we all have our reasons. What was it specifically that drew you to this story?
I think that all of my books are about a subculture or a culture or relationships of people. Oh, yeah. And there's a murderer in it, too. To me, that's always my focus. It's like I want to tell the story of the people. And when I looked at this, I had these two very diverse clans. I had Sue Snow's family, which was, you know, hardworking, you know, beautiful, clean, nice, you know. And then I had the other side, Stella's group, which was a hard scrapple, you know, and beer drinking, guzzling, all that kind of stuff that seems a little bit harsher. So there's a real split there. And yet they crossed over. So that's the story in my mind. It's always about the people.
Sure.
It's almost never about the crime. Do you know what I mean?
I do. Absolutely. It's anything that anyone who does what we do writes about true crime. It's always about more than just, oh, well, he shot him or he killed him or he strangled him or whatever it may be.
Right.
But there must have been something. I mean, just I know it myself. You know, there must be something that struck a chord in you.
Well, here's the thing. It happened in my neighborhood.
Okay. So that is it was something like that.
Yes. I mean, we got all the coverage of it, even though it was an international story at the time. We, you know, it could have been me. It could have been anybody. I mean, it was the Seattle area. I live in the Seattle area. Those bottles could have taken out anybody that I knew. And that's like when murder comes unexpectedly close to you or the possibility of it, I think you do take notice, right?
I do. I think you do. Yeah, I mean, I haven't done what you might describe as a neighborhood murder or a local murderer, but I've done an awful lot of people that, you know, you meet the victims' families, you meet the people who suffered and the dreadful price they pay for these random acts by people over whom they have no control. And it's no question that it is profoundly moving.
It is. And here's the thing. I also was moved by Stella's predicament and her family charter and all the things that had gone with her. It's not that I forgived her, you know, or thought that she was some kind of victim here, but I could look at her life and I could see that every single thing, whether it's a house, she had two house fires when she was a child, burned badly. She was gang raped at 13, had a baby at 14. She got beat up by her mother. She saw her little brother die at the breakfast table. I mean, everything terrible that could happen to her happened. So, you know, what does that person do? And how do you get out of that? And I kind of say there's no hope, but I was moved by that predicament for those people who don't have a chance.
No.
It doesn't forgive the murder.
Oh, no, I'm not suggesting that for a moment. But something also about her daughter. In a sense, there was that tension that you describe very elegantly in the book.
Yes.
Tension between the mother and the daughter. And that's very telling.
Yeah. Cindy Hamilton, who was Stella's daughter, who she had when she was 14, you know, she was in some ways a carbon copy of her mother. Mm-hmm. Hard, tough. Very sexual, all those kinds of things that Stella, you know, she had seen her mother act like, so she kind of mimicked her mom. Cindy was a tough cookie, and she was the one who really broke the case for the FBI by telling them that my mom had planned to kill my stepdad and the other ways that she did. So that's a fascinating dynamic, too. It's like it took 18 months to get Cindy to come across and tell the truth. You know, the FBI really worked her. They needed somebody. And this is what they told me, Jeffrey. They told me that in this case, which was so tough to prove because there were no witnesses seeing what was done. And it's an odd case. You know, it's product tampering. It's strange. It had never been prosecuted before. And they were building this important federal case. And they needed one person to tell the story that they would need to knit everything together. It could have been Stella. Stella could have said, hey, my daughter did it. She, you know, she didn't like my husband and blah, blah, blah. Or it could have been, you know, or Cindy could have squealed on Stella, which is fact is what she did. So it didn't matter who, they needed someone.
And in the end, it was Cindy, the daughter.
Yes, Cindy, who went before the court, told what she knew. And of course, as you know, reading the book, she got a big reward, $200,000 reward from the federal government and the drug companies for her testimony.
I find it very interesting because I've had this experience myself. You say in the acknowledgments of the book that Cindy was the one person you couldn't find.
For 30 years, I could not find her. I mean, and everybody looked for her. None of her friends, her family, her sister, no one ever saw her again after she walked out of that Seattle courtroom. No one saw her. Yeah. And finally, you know, she reached out to me on Facebook. You know, Facebook is strange. I have a couple of murderer people that I've written about that a friend of me have. I don't know if you've had that experience.
No, close, but not quite that.
So anyway, she reached out to me. She'd wanted some family photos and things because she didn't have anything from that time. And she knew that I had them. And so I gave them to her and we started talking. And, you know, I have to tell you that in my mind, for all these years, I had built up that she was possibly the killer too, you know, like a companion with her mother on the crime, that she was 10 times harder and colder than Stella. And, you know, that's what I'd been kind of like in my brain thinking about. But when I talked to her, I thought she was really funny. And she seemed, you know, she was the one that told me, you know, if my mom had kept the murder in the family, I wouldn't even have told on her. You don't bring murder outside the family, you know, so, which is, you know, a kind of a classic line. Well, that's good. We all need to know that. But I liked her.
Well, it's again another interesting element of this extraordinary case. And have you heard from Stella?
Well, I did see Stella, you know, many times in prison.
Did you?
Yes.
We can't do that as easily as we in England, Britain can't do that as easily as you can in America.
Yes,
for us, it's a real battle.
From the government won't let you or what?
Mostly the government.
Yeah.
Mostly the prison service.
Yeah,
they simply won't let you in.
That's terrible because, well, you know, here's the good news. And I'm sure you've talked to them on the phone or corresponded with killers. Usually, almost always, when I interview them in prison, and I have many times different prisons, you know that they're not going to give you the truth of what you really want.
No.
Because I've never met one that, you know, admitted they were guilty. So when I go in to meet somebody like Stella, I'm just looking for the shading to the story that's going to make it a better story. That's
another delicacy that adds that bit of dimension,
the details that make, you know, that help paint the picture. So I met her and, you know, she said, I'm looking at you, Mr. Olson, right now. I'm really good at sizing people up. And you're going to do a good job. You're going to write a good book about me. And then later when I wrote the book, it was being, you know, passed around to the prison and everything. Everybody in the, you know, somebody that was one of her cellmates, you know, wrote me a letter and said, we've all read it, you know. And then Stella finally read it and she said it was pretty fair. But
that's a great compliment to people like us.
Yes, it is. I should put that as a blurb on a cover of the book.
I mean, I did a book about a murderer here called Levi Belfield. And during his second trial, he said to me, you will make it a fair book about me, won't you? And I said, I'll do my best, you know. And he wrote to me saying, come and visit me. Prison service wouldn't let me in the door. It would be glamorizing murder, and we're not going to have that.
Well, I've always thought these books were really instructive in my mind. They didn't glamorize murder. No. All these crime books, I think the better ones really give you that nuance and those ideas about that pathway to murder, and maybe it helps you maybe see something in someone else's life. That's all.
I think that's true, Greg, and I think that's why it's such a fascinating opportunity to talk to you, because if you do what we do, certainly what I've done for 30 years, you have to deal with the concept that aren't you just being grotesque or ghoulish, or aren't you exploiting people's misery? Aren't you taking advantage of people's pain? And I don't believe that we are. I do believe that we're trying to explain what these crimes mean and what people are about. But it is a delicate argument. It's not one that you can just press the button and that's the right answer. It isn't as simple as that.
You know, Ann Rule, who was the great true crime writer in America, she said when she would get those complaints, she said, look, there are a lot of jobs that people do that are the result of tragedy, police, fire, you know, all those kinds of jobs, and lawyers, they exist because, you know, and writers are, you know, it is a job and we take it very seriously, and it's not exploitative. I don't believe it. Maybe some have been, I'm sure, but I'm really looking, and I know you are, I'm looking at a deep dive into something that you're not going to get in the newspaper. You're not going to get in the courtroom, because the courtroom has a story that they're wanting to tell.
Sure.
I'm having the story that is broader than that. And I hope it provides, you know, that kind of insightfulness that comes from really that deep dive into something that happened.
Yeah, I think that that's absolutely true. I agree with you wholeheartedly, but it is sometimes very difficult, because I'm often approached by people saying, oh, you talk about these dreadful things. And I say, well, you have absolutely no reason that you need to pick up the book or watch the television program. And they say, no, it's fascinating. And you say, well, what would you have me do? Do you want me to? I'm doing it with as much, I hope, as much sympathy and as much intelligence as I can bring to bear. I'm not, but you aren't either. This book is not a shovel full of horror.
No, it's actually not. It's pretty bloodless. But I will tell you this about, I also write crime fiction.
Mm.
And I've had a lot of people, you know, I can't read your true crime. It's so graphic or so horrific. And I'm thinking, well, what I write in crime fiction is way worse. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's like, but they're fine with that, because it's pretend. So I think, you know, I mean, I get that a lot, where people say, oh, that's, you know, I can't do nonfiction. It breaks my heart, blah, blah, blah. But then they're reading the most... whatever.
I know. Well,
that is, you know, about somebody getting cut up or trussed up or whatever, and they're fine with that.
Ghastly, ghastly. I mean, I review crime and thrillers in England and have done for many years. And I agree with you. True crime, by comparison, is rather tame. I've just read a book by a New Zealand-born author called Paul Cleave. It was about what he calls pain tourism, which is people who are fascinated by the misery and pain of crime scenes. And so they go to crime. I mean, honestly, and it's far worse than any true.
I need to get into that. I need to start.
It's far worse than any true crime book I've ever done. And I'm sure you
want a misery cruise.
Yes. I mean, and it's called the pain tourist. Mm. I mean, it's horrific in every way, but it's gripping, very well done. He's very smart. And he's done a series, which is now being made, I think, for Netflix or Amazon, called The Cleaner, which is about crime scene cleaners. You know, the guys who go in after the police have left and clean up the scene. And it's a six-parter. And the cleaners become their own detectives, which is actually quite a smart idea.
Yes,
they become the detectives. I think we can solve this. You know,
yes, I think
we know better than CSI. We know better than forensics. You know,
we all know better than CSI now, because we're all fully trained by watching TV.
Yes. But Greg, I mean, this is obviously a project that's been with you, but what about what are you going on to do apart from crime fiction? What are you going to do, another true crime?
Oh, yes. I'm going back actually to the very first book I ever wrote, which was about a gay Amish serial killer. I don't know, you know, the Amish are people in our country that, you know, don't have electricity and all that. I wrote a book called Abandoned Prayers. Mm-hmm. And the book opens with the death of an Amish man's wife, which was suspicious, but never charged or anything. He later was convicted of the murder of a roommate. But I'm going back to that story 30 years later, and I'm going to break the case.
Good for you.
I'm gonna prove she was murdered. I've got billboards going up next week in Amish country. I'll send you a link so you can see them. But I feel like some stories hang on, and maybe this has happened to you. They hang on in your head. You can't really shake them. And very often that's all they're ever going to do. But I feel like right now I have an opportunity to go back to something when I was young. I was 32 or 33 when I wrote that book. And I'm going to now look at it with older, more experienced eyes, see what I can come up with.
It sounds very interesting. There is actually a current crime thriller about a true crime writer who seems to be involved in all the crimes he then writes about.
And the suggestion
is that he's actually the killer, because he always seems to solve the case.
He's always there.
He's always there. So
I gotta watch myself.
It is slightly odd, but this is a conversation that only people who do what we do could actually have.
I wanted to tell you, I'm also working on a podcast like everybody else, right?
I got into this by accident. I 5 years ago.
It's so smart, because I've learned, you know, that storytelling is always evolving and changing, and people consume a lot of audio now. It seems to be.
They do.
And it's younger people. And I look at, you know, my audience, and they're my age or older, most of these readers of books.
Yeah.
And I'm going after the younger readers. So I was inspired by my book called If You Tell, which was a huge bestseller. I mean, published in like 20 countries. It's about three sisters whose parents are abusing and killing people. And they finally come forward and confess what was happening. And I heard from so many other women who were abused or who had similar situations with their own parents. So I'm working on, I've been interviewing people and putting it together. I'm real excited about giving that a try.
That sounds wonderful. It's very good. I mean, let's finish by saying my congratulations. I think the book's very good. It is in some senses very American. It's not instantly, and it's not headlines. In other words, it's not an instant name killer,
right.
But it's nevertheless a wonderful examination of what drives and what happens to people and why they do it. And that's what I think, the delicacy, the elegance of that, I think is what appealed to me enormously. And I have to freely confess, it's a delight to talk to someone who does the same as I do. You know, that.
And as soon as we're done, I'm ordering all your books.
it's a kind of, gosh, I mean, there really are other people out there who do this.
There are.
Because there are. You do get quite, well, you will know, very internal.
Mm-hmm.
You get turn in yourself.
Have you ever become depressed about anything you were writing about? I'm just going to turn the tables on you. Has it ever really gotten down, you know, where you just thought, this is too much?
I think it's fair to say, and I've talked to a couple of people about this, anyone who describes horror, evil, whatever you want to call it, monstrous behavior, is changed by that experience. It lodges in your mind. You can't lose it. You can't take it away. You can lock it up, but it never goes away. And once heard or seen, or whether you're in the court or whether you watch the crime, whether you go look to the crime scene photographs, whether you watch the video, whatever it is, you can't leave. It's gone. It's with you. And the trick, if there is a trick, is to try and keep always a sense of perspective, always a sense of proportion. Never let it overtake you, because if you do, you'll get very, very, very depressed very quickly. Because, I mean, I've done hundreds and hundreds of cases on television, podcasts, and, you know, books, but I think I'm still just about sane. I wouldn't say I was completely sane, but I would say I was broadly sane.
I'll have to check on Reddit to see how sane you are.
That's quite.
But I will tell you, when you're saying that, I want you to know that my mind flashed on certain things that I recall that are there forever. And for me, the one that always I come back to, I never wrote about it, but When I was very young, I went into the evidence locker on a case that I ended up not writing about. It was a double homicide. And one of the victims was an 8-year-old girl. And her Holly Hobby lunchbox, which was like a character lunchbox, all bloodied, was, you know, wrapped up in like brown paper, butcher paper, was, you know, in the evidence room. And I just looked at that. And I mean, like, for me, those kinds of images, it's not the photo of the dead girl, but it's like some of those little things that you never ever see that haunt me.
Yeah. I think it would be fair to say that you can't do what you do or I do without being haunted to some extent. It's just a question of how you handle the haunting. But Greg, thank you so much. Let me just repeat. The book's called American Mother. Greg Olson is the author. It was published in Britain on the 8th of November by Thread. And I heartily recommend it. And Greg, thank you so much, especially for getting up so early.
Oh, yeah. The sun is out now. Thanks so much.
Well, that's a relief.
You're a delight.
Well, thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you feel that you learned a bit more about what it's like to write true crime and what it's like to deal with these kinds of cases. I'd be fascinated to hear from you about whether you enjoyed it, whether you thought we should have done it in a different way. Also, I'd like a feedback from you about how you felt. You can get us on Instagram, BloodTies_podcast. You can find me and an email me if you go to my website, which is jeffreywansall.com. And I'd be fascinated to hear what you felt and whether you enjoyed it, whether you thought it was interesting or what you liked. But in the meantime, I have to thank everybody who helps us, Sam Brain, our wonderful producer, my brother Dan, who did the music, George, who drew the caricature, and of course, my daughter Molly, who without her inspiration, this podcast would never have happened. But as I often say at the end of these podcasts, unfortunately, bad things happen to good people, so do be careful out there.